Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Anxiety was high in the nation's capital over the weekend that a planned Unite the Right rally on Sunday would turn violent. That's what happened a year ago when a Charlottesville, Virginia rally organized by the same group got out of control and resulted in the death of an anti-Nazi protester. But instead, in D.C. on Sunday evening, about two dozen white nationalists showed up, hugely outnumbered by counter-protesters. Today in The Exchange, we sit down with Granite Staters who watch these white supremacist movements, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have four guests for the hour with us in studio: Reverend Eric Jackson, pastor at Brookside Congregational Church in Manchester, president of the Greater Manchester NAACP. And Reverend Jackson, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Also with us, Tom White, coordinator of educational outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College. And Tom, we'll welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your
time.
Good
morning, Laura. Thank you.
Also with us, Rabbi Robin Nafshi of Temple Beth Jacob here in Concord. And Rabbi Nafshi, thank you again for coming back. We appreciate it.
Always my pleasure.
And also with us, Jerry Ann Bogus, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire, a nonprofit that focuses on the state's African-American history. And Jerry Ann, welcome back to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Laura. Great
well,
to be here.
I want to start with all of you, but I'll go around the table. So start with you, Jerry Ann, just your reaction to what happened this week in D.C. or didn't happen
in D.C. The pleasant surprise that nothing happened. And it was a relief that there was no violence. And it was a relief to see that the numbers for the Nazi group were so small. But in reading a little bit about it, they were not organized and their message was conflicting in that they couldn't, they were trying to be peaceful and carry a message of white power. But no violence, no flags that said this. So it was, you know, their own message was confusing to their own group. So the people who wanted to really raise that voice of white supremacy in a very angry way, I don't think joined in that group that came. So that was good to see. And on the other side, it was good to see that the community turned out in such numbers to protest their movement, their being on the mall in D.C. So it gives us that kind of, I don't want to say false sense of security in that this may be passing, but it gives us a sense of hope.
What do you think, Rabbi Nafshi?
I wish I too could say that it was giving us a sense of it's passing, but I agree it's not. One of the most telling articles I had read in advance were about several of the co-organizers of the rally in Charlottesville from a year ago who urged their followers not to participate because they didn't want to look like, in their words, quote, lunatic fringe, as if their message in and of itself was not lunacy or fringe. And maybe it's not to larger numbers of people in our country, and that's a part of what makes this so frightening, that there is ongoing attempts, ongoing desires, and media coverage. So they're getting still, even if there are only 24 people, do a Google search for DC rally, Unite the Right, and you're going to have every major media outlet covered it. And that for them is a success, even if there were only 24 people. because their message, as long as CNN is covering it and ABC and Washington Post and New York Times, even if they're speaking that there were only 24, Kessler's name gets out there, some message that he had gets out there, even as a statement of saying so few of them. Doesn't matter. Their message is still being promoted or being at least presented in the media.
So we'll talk in a little bit later definitely about media coverage, so I'm glad you raised that. But not a – so Rabbi Nashi, some people are saying, hey, this is a victory lap for, you know, forces aligned against hatred. You're not feeling a victory lap.
No, I'm not feeling a victory lap. I think any time the opposition, the voice of normalcy and love and anti-hate has to come out in numbers, that's not a victory.
Tom White, you track these groups. You watch these movements. As I said, you're with the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. So you've looked at this a lot. What do you think?
I think there are two things to consider. And, you know, the context of victory creates this dynamic of sort of this either or, we win, they lose. And I think one of the most helpful ways to look at this for us and the white majority in the country, that it isn't a lose-win situation. It's a win-win situation. If we can curtail these voices of hate, it benefits all of us. And when racists have come to power, and we have seen that throughout all of our history, which is what I hope Americans are wrestling with, anytime there's been any kind of racial progress, there has been an immediate and vicious, overwhelming backlash against the black community. And that could be in the formation of Jim Crow after the Civil War, where you had, you know, armed black veterans who were combat veterans of the Civil War annihilated. And the whole argument about gun rights had begun from a white majority Southern position to take guns away from blacks who were defending themselves in the South. You had this emplacement of Jim Crow, which, of course, legalized slavery once again. And that was all a backlash to emancipation and what the Civil War had been fought about, which was the end of slavery. After World War I, you know, the first units that were serving that great to great acclaim were black units. And when they came back, they faced, you know, the Red Summer, where 25 cities were attacked and destroyed to make sure they wouldn't find any progress. And now we have this iteration of this kind of hatred and by a president who, of course, did the birther thing and all this kind of stuff. Why? As a reaction to a black president coming in. So this is historic in America. And we have to look at that as every time these racists come to power, it hurts all of us. And this is a time where white rights are restricted as well as black. So I think for as Americans, we have to look in context. It's not a win-lose. It is basically we all lose if racism comes to the fore.
So as Jerry Ann and Rabbi Nashi touched on, you know, some outlets are saying this morning, hey, this is a victory for forces aligned against extremism and hate. You're not feeling a victory? Yes or no? Tom, what do you think?
I just don't like that dynamic because it's an ongoing struggle that will always be part of our dynamic as Americans. It will always come as a backlash to any kind of progress that we make. And so this is an everyday struggle of decency. And so, you know, I can wake up and feel good about that, but at the same time, I'm not one of the targeted people, so I can't claim victory or success or joy or whatever it may be. All I can do is to listen to the voices of the targeted and find out how they are doing.
Reverend Jackson, how are you feeling about this morning?
So my feeling is, the way I'm feeling right now is that this moment of what happened where you only had 24 people attending the rally is symbolic of the collective power of people to actually make a difference. So for me, it's an example of what happens when people come together and are not silent and resist, because the 24 not showing up was just it was more than just the it was more than just people making the decision not to come because they didn't want to be outed or anything like that. But also there were economic implications that happened as well that impacted their capacity to actually be able to even hold a rally similar to what happened last year. So for me, I see this as a moment that symbolizes what happens when people really come together and say no to white supremacy and no to hatred. But I also, on the other hand, I see it, the victory for me, that's where the victory is. But it doesn't still change the fact that just because you had 24 people at the rally doesn't mean that all of those people who participated in Charlottesville, both directly and indirectly, are not still there. No, these, this force is very much still alive and still active.
When you say economic impact, you're referring to Reverend Jackson, correct me if I'm wrong, that some of the people who participated, excuse me, last year in Charlottesville lost their jobs, lost their ability to raise money and so forth.
Yes, those kinds of things, along with some of the things we were talking about earlier, with their inability to really be able to even fundraise for this.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. I want to pick up on something that Rabbi Nafshi said, and Rabbi Nafshi, I'll go to you first. You talked about the attention that these groups get, and that even though, yes, only 24 people showed up, even though it did not turn violent, they got the attention, they're all over the news, anything you Google, they're going to show up. So just talk a little bit more about the attention that these groups get, and what's the right kind of attention, in your opinion?
It's a difficult question to answer, in that anytime we see any kind of expression of hate, be it graffiti on somebody's garage door, this rally attempting to garner support for the Unite the Right and white supremacists, what do you do? Do you cover it or not? Because covering it is exactly what they're looking for. And at the same time, by not covering it, we're not providing to the general public the fact that there's newsworthy events happening. I know recently there was a synagogue in the Midwest that there was a lot of Nazi graffiti, swastikas and other things on their building. And they were struggling. What do you do? You know, do you report this? Do you just simply go over and paint over it? How do you deal with it? And I think we always wrestle with that because we don't want to give attention to the haters, which is exactly what they're looking for. I said a name earlier. Maybe I shouldn't have even said his name. That's what he's looking for, right? Is that kind of attention? And yet we expect the media to do its job and report for us on what is happening. I certainly turned to news sources this morning in preparation for coming on the show and making sure that what I had read last night remained the same this morning. I think we have to take it on a case-by-case basis. Clearly, something that is meant to be an anniversary of the events in Charlottesville needs to have coverage. I think when we have some local events, we have to be very careful about how we respond to it. And so in the Jewish community, often we're told to report things to the local police, report things to the FBI, report things to the Anti-Defamation League, but not necessarily go to the media.
That's interesting.
Because the people who perpetrate whatever they do, that's what they're looking for, is more attention. And by going to the media, they're getting exactly what they want.
That's really interesting. What do you think, Jerrianne?
Well, I'm torn with this idea. I think that we really need to have media coverage on these incidents. I think it's very important for us to bring to light these issues. Our country has never had this dialogue about racism in such a way that we can look from our history of slavery to where we are now. It's the whole story of what that has brought. So I think that was one of the things I was worried about, with just the few numbers showing up, that movement's going underground. And when it goes underground, it goes into neighborhoods. It goes to personal. It gets more violent. When you bring it to the light, you have a chance for a dialogue about it. And you have what we saw. You protesters coming around that notion, that idea that they're trying to pass. So for me, it's really important that the news covers it. We don't need to sensationalize it, and we don't have to run 24 hours a day. But it's important for us to know what's going on, to know what people are thinking, know where they're coming from, and get a real good snapshot of what our country is. I think for so long we had believed that we had moved beyond this white supremacist Nazi KKK notion. But Charlottesville showed us clearly that we have not moved that needle. We haven't moved that needle far enough.
Tom, you want to jump in? This is a very tricky subject.
And we deal with this all the time where we have, you know, with our Jewish community here and the threats that they receive, or we have hate groups that are trying to operate around us. And we're always doing threat assessments. So is what they're saying picking up traction anywhere around us? And if so, we evaluate the situation in one of does it need publicity or does it not? And for example, there was a famous Holocaust denier who will remain nameless who was trying to come to Manchester a couple of years ago. And the Jewish community called me, and they were very afraid and had every right to be. But we talked about, are you seeing any of support for his coming to Manchester? And there was none. So he was looking for free publicity. He, of course, has been banned in Europe. He has no money. And this was his way to get money, to sort of have us respond to him and get free publicity. So we counseled not to do that, but prepare everybody about if there was ramifications for his being here, then we'd have to respond to it. In that we didn't respond to him at all, no one knew if he ever came or not to this day. So there was no free publicity. He disappeared. Now, at other times, if there is a real threat, someone is speaking, and there is a public response to him, we must respond to that some way. I think you have to assess the threat. But I think what's really helpful now and healthy is for the first time social media, YouTube, Facebook, all of that, is for the first time realizing that they're a news source and they're beginning to vet what they're putting up there. So I wrote something a couple of days ago saying this is very, very healthy, that you can't give equal platform to people with hate ideas. These aren't equal ideas. These are repulsive ideas that have no place in our republic. You cannot put them as CNN does, sort of a here's the racist and here's the non-racist, and they have an equal platform, and therefore they're equated. I think it's a huge mistake. And I think them being barred from putting their things on YouTube is not suppression of free speech. And I think you're absolutely correct. Free speech is what saves us as Americans because we respond to it. But when publishers and platforms for news vet what's on there, I think that's very healthy, and it's not a suppression of free speech. They still have their Twitter accounts. They still have their soapboxes to stand on. But we have every right to assess truth, to assess decency, to assess scholarship, and not give them an equal and fair platform.
Definitely want to follow up on that free speech comment. But yeah, Rabbi Nafshi and then Reverend Jackson, go ahead.
Well, and I think what Tom is making reference to, one of the examples that's going around now, and Tom has been a very active participant in trying to bring this information off of Facebook, is Zuckerberg's willingness to have Holocaust deniers essentially have their opportunity to freely speak through Facebook, and he's been fairly mixed on how he's responded to it, and try to sort of saying, "Oh, it's a free speech issue. Of course, I find the ideas repulsive, but," and as I responded to something Tom sent out the other day and saying, there can be a diversity of opinions, and Facebook is a great place for a diversity of opinions. Holocaust denial is not an opinion;
it's an untruth.
What about media coverage, Reverend Jackson, and how much attention you give this, and how much you're giving people who want attention the attention they crave?
I think dealing with media and attention, I think the most important thing for me is to always keep it on the issue and not on the and not on the individual. So I think the individual spotlight is what folks like this crave. So I think keeping the narrative and the conversation about the issue and the values here that are problematic and what we can do about them, I think if we stay on that, I think that's a good medium to prevent these folks from, these names, if you will, from gaining publicity.
All right. I'm going to follow up more with you on that after a short break, because that's interesting, too. And remember, you can join us with your comments, thoughts, wide open discussion today on this in the Exchange. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org.
New New Hampshire Public Radio listeners are educated, engaged, and digitally savvy. As an NHPR underwriter, your business can reach this digital audience through our many podcasts, our e-newsletters, or at our award-winning news site, nhpr.org. Learn how you can reach the best and brightest online community in New Hampshire and beyond by visiting the business support page at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire reaction to this weekend's Unite the Right rally on the anniversary of a white supremacy rally in Virginia. We're sitting down with Granite Staters who watch these white supremacy movements and how the country has responded, especially this time in D.C., where the rally pretty much fizzled out after very few white supremacists showed up. Let's hear from you, your thoughts, reflections. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests. Jerry Ann Bogus is here, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. That's a nonprofit that focuses on the state's African-American history. Also with us, Reverend Eric Jackson, pastor at Brookside Congregational Church in Manchester and president of the Greater Manchester NAACP. Rabbi Robin Nafshi is here. She's the leader at Temple Beth Jacob in Concord. And Tom White is with us, coordinator of educational outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, just before the break, we were talking about media coverage. And, you know, these days, media coverage doesn't just mean CBS, The New York Times, NPR. It means social media. It means places where people can put whatever they want. And Reverend Jackson, you were starting to go there, so I want to let you finish and then hear from everybody else. There is a confused, conflicted role of social media in all this in terms of organizing and then denying and then advertising or at least putting the information out there. And I'd love more of your thoughts there, please.
So just to continue from where I left off earlier, I think it's very important for the values piece to be the center of it and not the individuals involved, because that gives them a lot more media attention. And on the other hand, what happens is the counter effect, where people who might be flirting with these ideas now are magnetized now towards that these individuals. But on the other hand, though, especially with social media, I think social media has allowed a different narrative to be introduced. There's an old quote that says, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. So, you know, when we're not able to see it in the history books, when the record is written, a lot of the times those things that we're seeing now pop up, even from calls of when people have made calls to the police with black people just sitting on the sitting on the stairs, and trying to enjoy themselves. I think what social media has done, though, has allowed history to be able told in a more grassroots way that allows the hunted to also be seen and have their story told.
So that's what I was going to add to. With social media and the rise of cell phones, all these things that had been invisible to the public, police brutality, implicit biases, acts of, you know, racism, were hidden from public view. And now that we have those outlets, we can see them. What we do need to do is have this talk, this dialogue, educating about implicit bias and more conversations about it. You know, more conversations about our history, more conversations about how it affects people, and visibly seeing the effect of racism on a person, I think creates that space, that opening to have that dialogue.
So here's something that I did a ton of reading this morning and last night, obviously, but this is a short piece from a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, author of the book Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. And I won't read the whole thing, but here's what he says. As we reckoned with violent white men swarming my town, Charlottesville, Virginia, in August 2017, we could no longer ignore the fact that they all found each other and whipped each other into a frenzy because digital tools made it so easy. After that, 2018 was destined to be the year that we finally confronted the monsters that we had unleashed. He says, after Charlottesville, the public finally connected Silicon Valley's hubris to its culture of toxic masculinity. Wow. There's a lot there, but basically he's saying Silicon Valley, he says, is a shallow, unarticulated libertarianism that rests on the assumption that government functions and all the democratic accountability that supports them are archaic and inefficient. So what do you think about this, Rabbi Nafshi, the idea that in 2017, the public finally connected Silicon Valley's hubris to its culture of toxic masculinity? You have people, you know, saying, sure, it's an open forum, put whatever you want. You know, we don't need sort of people wagging their fingers at us.
I think he's giving Silicon Valley a little bit too much credit. I think there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley who are looking to make money. And they are some incredibly creative and talented people who have delivered to us different aspects of social media and different platforms in social media. But beyond that, I don't think I share his thoughts. And to the extent that the white supremacists were able to rally themselves in 2017 and speak to each other through social media to get to Charlottesville, so were the counter-protesters. And I think that's what we saw yesterday in 2018, where you had very few of the white supremacists showing up for various and sundry reasons. And part of it is that they don't have the funds. They can't advertise. Most of the ways that they try to use social media financially, they're cut off from. But you have the anti-protesters who very much are able to speak to each other as well and through social media and come together. And I think we see that. I think, you know, I've known Reverend Jackson now for several years, and what I love about him, many things, but one is I see him as one of these eternal optimists and looking for the good in people and in things and in platforms. And I think that's something that we did see yesterday, how social media can be used for the good to bring people together and people who share values. And, you know, some of the groups that have arisen, for example, on Facebook in the last few years, one of them, Pantsuit Nation, which began as a support for Hillary Clinton, obviously, and the wearing of pantsuits. But it's become so much more. And it's really an opportunity for people who support each other in opposing the kinds of messages that the white supremacists were trying to deliver yesterday. It's a place where people can really come together in love and in community and in sharing what's important in their lives and on a very individual basis. And you see people reaching out to each other. I'm going to be in your town. And they begin to meet each other. And it allows, it breaks down a lot of barriers as well. So I think he's, the author is giving Silicon
Valley.
He's
a little too negative.
Well, it's not even just that he's negative. I they're business people. I mean, they may be creative and, you know, they're business people. The bottom line is their dollar. I mean, you know, what they're doing is how they can make money in the social media. They didn't start these ventures, I don't believe, for altruistic purposes. Let's unite America in some way and we'll do something. They're making a lot of money on what they do.
So you might say it's up to everybody else to decide what they do with these tools.
Yes and no. I mean, I still go back to the other point I made about also then allowing for pure false information to perpetrate across or perpetuate across these, which I think is its own danger. And they're not government. So it's because they're not government, it's not a First Amendment issue. Quite frankly, the First Amendment is that the government shall not suppress, you know, make laws banning speech. Private enterprise can do it anytime, and it does. I mean, think about gag rules and workplace, you know, we do it all the time. So social media should not be allowed to stand behind, in my opinion, the First Amendment. You know, the media, what we traditionally think of as the media, has sort of adopted that, you know, First Amendment piece for themselves. But quite frankly, they don't have to. They don't print everything. They make decisions. So they choose not to print things. And in some ways, that's suppressing speech. You don't take an ad from anyone who pays for an ad. You don't have to because they're not government and neither is social media.
Tom?
Yeah, for me, it's interesting because I think, you know, you look at group dynamics, or you look at social media dynamics, what they do is amplify what's already there. And now we have this sort of new amplification of social media. But all of this in our discussions today, I think, still lack context. It's all about Charlottesville or what's happening currently, but we miss the fact that this has been going on for 200, 300, 400 years in our country. For example, in the 1930s and 40s, you saw the rise of the German-American Bund, which was a Nazi movement in America. Germans made the second largest immigration community in America. The Bund was very popular. Hitler, Mussolini, Franco were very popular in American society. FDR was actually asked once to become a dictator like them to solve our problems, and he refused to. But when you saw the Bund marching or the KKK marching in the 20s, there were counter rallies to them that far outnumbered them. There was a Madison Square Garden rally, for example, in 1939 that the Bund sponsored, along with the Daughters and Sons of the American Revolution and what would become the America First Committee, which we hear America First again. All of these people were surprised about America First, but this has always been part of our culture. Nothing is surprising here. And America First first got started as, I can remember, a medallion I saw from the KKK in the 1920s, and their slogan was America First. So these aren't big news items for us. These are things that are always there, and we're missing that continuous context that I think this dynamic of us responding to this kind of racism has always been part of American culture. And one of my heroes was a reverend in Connecticut. When the Bund tried to go and set up another camp, training camp in Connecticut, he rallied everybody, all the ministers, rabbis, and others, and they stood together, and the camp never came to Connecticut. And I guess the last thing I want to say is, you know, we deal with anti-Semitism, racism, bigotry. They're all the same issue. They just have different iterations and different sponsors. And I can't help but think of how the Nazis got started, and that was against the Rhineland blacks of the 1920s. They vilified a handful of blacks who had been born to German and French civilians, and this is how the Nazis got their start. And when they formed the Nuremberg Laws, the way they articulated them is they went to the one country on earth that had laws against interracial marriage, and that was the United States. And the entire precedence for the Nuremberg Laws came from American race tradition. And I think that's something we need to talk about. So it's not just Charlottesville. It's how these ideas of bigotry, anti-Semitism, are all deeply related, and we all need to respond to them and have.
Well, and you said, Tom, that, you know, given your historical knowledge, and that's really interesting what you said, that nothing is surprising when we know that history. But I think a lot of Americans don't know that history.
Right.
And, Jerry, and maybe you first, after Charlotte, a lot of Americans who aren't as involved in these issues as the four of you said, wow, what? Who? White supremacy? America? 2017? I mean, how surprising do you think it is to the average American that these white supremacy movements still exist, 2017?
Well, I think our majority never have to think about white supremacy because they're part of the majority. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that affects them. You know, the issues affect our people of color, our underrepresented groups. So we have to always be aware of what's going on. We have to always be aware of where we are, what we're doing, and who we're doing it with at all times. So it's something the majority never has to think about. So we're not surprised when white supremacists raise this ugly head in our environment. Racism was started in this country. The whole notion of race started around enslavement of Africans. And the Africans and indentured servants, who were largely Irish at the time, were all getting along. They were intermarrying. They were having kids. There was nothing of this vitriol nature that we have now. But the underclass was outnumbering the owning class. And so there was this fear, this huge fear, and we still see that today, of people who have been treated badly rising up. So in that, what they did was they created the separation, and they separated by skin color and made the indentured servants the overseers. So we can separate, and that's where the whole notion of race starts. It's economics.
If
right?
you divide people,
you divide
then they
people,
won't unite and
they
fight
can't
you.
Unite, and we still see that in all the ways that we do now. You know, I mean, the issues are the issues that we have around economics, around people's well-being, health care, you know, living wages, and all of that. They're at the heart of what we do, but we're focused more on creating, on looking at and keeping that notion that blacks are inferior to white. And that's something really ingrained in America's DNA that's really hard for us to move beyond.
So to people who watched those rallies last year and said, oh my gosh, look at the Nazis, neo-Nazis saying things about Jews, look at the white supremacists saying things about people of color, how can this be America in 2017? You would say,
it's always America.
No surprise.
This is America.
Jerrion Bogus is not surprised.
No.
Reverend Jackson, were you surprised? And I can see you want to jump in too, Tom. Yeah.
Was I surprised? No, I was not not surprised. Because one, I mean, we've seen this cycle manifest itself throughout history in
like
a
Tom
variety
said,
of iterations, as both Tom and Jerrion had alluded to. And two, it's not surprising for me because, since especially I think one marker is the current occupant in the White House, it was very clear as time has been progressing since that. So you've seen a lot of white nationalists that have been emboldened in this particular moment in time. So I'm not surprised at what we have been seeing because of the fact that white nationalists have been given allowed to grow and to integrate themselves into the mainstream of society through this administration.
And by the way, I didn't ask you this at the beginning. Were you surprised by what happened this past weekend in this sort of anniversary rally by the fact that, you know, I mean, you gave your reaction earlier, but I'm just wondering, were you surprised? Because you're probably bracing for another Charlottesville.
Somewhat, but I did not place much expectation around whether there'd be a large turnout or whether there'd be a smaller turnout. I just knew that either way, something was going to happen. I think what most concerned me the most was the fact that what lingered in my mind was the fact that they were still given a platform. To hold the rally in the first place.
Yeah, and we talked about that sort
yeah,
of
so
attention.
Yeah, that's where I am with the rally being held on the 12th. So it's not about numbers for me. It's the fact that in this day and age, they could still be being given a platform.
Tom, you wanted to jump in, and then Rabbi Nash, I have another question for you. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, here I'm speaking as a white man from New Hampshire, and I'm always very cautious that I do not know targeting. I've been very fortunate. And so a colleague of mine, I was at a conference in Mobile, Alabama recently, and he said, I was with a black friend of mine, and he's a white professor. He pulled in really quickly to the store, pulled up on the sidewalk, ran in. You know, he got his thing, he ran out, and he ran off to the show. But his friend in the front seat just said, "What are you doing?" He said, "If I did that, I would have been shot." And he said,
jumping out of the car, running into a convenience
store
and running
and
out.
So this white professor said, there was my wake-up call. I think one thing that can help reshape the debate is this idea that we have bigots and idiots who have risen to power and have this power. I don't think that's how this works. I think what you have are well-placed individuals who see it in their self-interest to play the race card. And that's always paid off. And if it's really more about self-interest and what works in the moment, if we can shift that discussion to it's in our best self-interest to protect those who are being targeted, for all of us in our republic, this is what the Bill of Rights is designed to do, protect minorities, not
protect
minorities.
So when you say our self-interest, you're talking everybody.
Everybody. Because when you start having restrictive laws and you start having targeting, as I know as a Holocaust educator, doesn't know any boundaries. And those who are in power with the self-interest to promote hatred and racism target more than just one group of people. So all of us are at risk when any one of our rights are taken away.
All right. More after a short break. We'll start taking your calls and emails as well. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Steve Marchand is here. So send us your questions for Mr. Marchand to exchange at nhpr.org. Again, exchange at nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for that interview. This hour, New Hampshire reaction to this weekend's Unite the Right rally that fizzled out in D.C. this weekend. We're talking with four Granite Staters who watch these white supremacy movements, getting their thoughts. And we'd like your thoughts as well. 1-800-892-6477. Lou from Richmond sent us an email, all of you. He says, I feel that the overwhelming number of anti-protesters that showed up yesterday proves that one person, you, can make a difference if you get involved, just like voting. Lou says, I think the D.C. turnout proves that if more people vote, you, he says, the result will be what the majority wants, not what the loudest want. Lou, thank you for the email. Again, you can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Rabbi Nasi, just for the break, I was asking our other guests if they were surprised by what we saw in Charlottesville in 2017. You know, you saw a lot of commentary in the general media of people saying, wow, you know, I didn't know that this sentiment existed to such a large extent in America in 2017. Thought we'd move beyond all that racism and anti-Semitism. Seems very old-fashioned. Were you surprised?
Not one bit. If I remember, in Charlottesville in 2017, the rally, Unite the Right rally, they began early in the morning. It was a Saturday morning. They began at the house of worship of the only synagogue in Charlottesville, and they were chanting tremendous anti-Semitic epithets outside the synagogue. And
I had forgotten that that's where they started.
As they walked into town,
that's
shouting,
deliberate,
"Jews
isn't it?
Will not yeah. replace us. Jews will not replace us." You know, the Jewish community was not deemed to be white until about the mid part of the 20th century. And so we share very much in the target notion that the African-American community has experienced and many others who have come to this country. The first Jews who showed up here in this country almost 400 years ago were turned away by Peter Stuyvesant, you know, didn't want the Jews to come into the country. At the time, there were Jews on the board of the Dutch East India Company, which, of course, owned New Amsterdam. And those Jews wrote back to the board, and Stuyvesant was required to let them in. And that's how the first Jews arrived here. But it was not a surprise to anybody or anybody in the Jewish community, that what occurred in Charlottesville occurred. We experience it all the time. If it's not our own communities being targeted, we see it all across our country. Of Jewish communities being targeted constantly, either phone threats, graffiti left on buildings. I had it happen to me. I remember going back to my hometown for my 10th high school reunion back in the 1980s, late 80s, and our synagogue had anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi graffiti all over it. And teens came together from the local high school, Jewish and non-Jewish, to clean it up. But you know, if you're a Jewish person in this country, you, much like others who have been targeted, you live with it. And so, something like Charlottesville a year ago would never surprise you.
Speaking of phone threats, Jerry and Bogus, I wonder if I could ask you about some phone threats that you received after you participated in a panel discussion on expanding diversity here in New Hampshire, the workforce, brought together by some of the state's biggest employers, you know, Eversource and the university system and so forth. And from what our reporters here at NHPR reported, you came out feeling really optimistic. This is, you know, great that we're talking about this. And then what happened, Jerian?
So after that, that forum, and the article in the New York Times that said, I forgot the headlines, state 94% why a group of people are trying to change that. I did get, along with a lot of us that were in that article, got hate emails, and I got a phone call. But I think the call that I got was really surprising. First of all, one, it was a woman, so who was calling and asked, you know, to speak to me. She didn't know she was speaking to me because I wanted to know who it was, and she wouldn't give me her name. But just the hate that she started spewing after that, you know, when she didn't know who she was talking to because she didn't get, she didn't know it was me. And then she was saying I think when she was saying that you want to, by diversifying the state, I'm killing her children. She says, what do you want, to kill my children? I'm the mother of two white children. That's when I really heard in her voice, fear, actual fear, that my existence for just being a person of color was detriment to her children. And it, I let her talk, she was screaming on, and I just started to think about that, you know, that it was this deep belief that just being black was detrimental, whether it would be a racist type that we're violent people, or whether it's, you know, we'll overtake the world by our color and white people will no longer exist. It was just really strange to me. And I was just taken aback by that, just that notion. And I, you know, the work that we do here is spreading the, trying to get rid of stereotypes, telling the stories, the past stories of African Americans here in New Hampshire, a state that's normally not considered to have black history. And I said, well, there is no way I can reach that person. You know, and for the first time I was looking, because, you know, this is what we do. And I say, yeah, we can change hearts and minds. But in hearing her spew that hate, it was, there's no place for me to get in. There's no opening in where she could hear what I had to say, because she was busy screaming. And then this deeply held belief, you know, wouldn't allow her to hear a message of inclusion. And I, for just that moment, I was going, what are we doing? Our job's hopeless. Just for that moment. And then I had to think. I had to think of people like Daryl Davis, or, you know, he's working with, changing KKK members and just breaking them. He had 200 men turning their robes. And he believed that dialogue can do this. So I thought of somebody like that and what you have to believe. And I think that we just have to keep doing what we're doing, telling these stories, because you'll never know when their heart will open enough to hear a message. It just has to be a sliver of something that gets in to change someone's mind. So I can't afford to be hopeless. I have to really think that some outside action can open up a heart to look at all of us as humans and not as this fear thing of somebody, and, you know, getting rid of us.
I want to ask everybody on that issue of, you know, hearts, minds, hope, and so forth, but a very practical question for you, please, Jerianne. When you get a very scary threat like that, I mean, it's a threat against your kids, do you report it to the police? Do you, you know, buy a home security system if you don't have one already? Do you walk around with a bulletproof vest? I mean, what do you do when you get a very scary threat like that?
Of course, all those things come to mind. Well, how do I protect myself? How do I protect my children? How do I protect my home?
Right.
And yes, I reported it to police. And yes, it was reported to the Attorney General's office. And so you take all those steps to protect yourself. But I think it's also important not to close yourself off because of fear. You can't work and do this job if you're afraid, because then you'll stop. You just can't. You know, if I allow myself to, I mean, it's there. The environment that we live in, everybody is suspect now. When you go out on the street and you go, well, where am I? What am I doing?
And it's, is that
fear,
screaming woman out there,
yeah,
somewhere,
exactly,
with, you know.
It's a sense that I never had before. Not because of this caller, but the environment that I now find myself in New Hampshire. You know, it's like when you go by and you see certain signs next to a neighbor's house that you never thought, oh my God, that's the belief they have. And then you wonder, you're just curious now and more cautious. And every person I speak to has that same sense of being cautious of entering into new situations. So, yes, we have that. We have to be cautious, but we can't let it stop us from living our daily lives, doing what we normally do, and do the work that has to be done. We have to speak up. We have to tell these stories. We have to raise attention on what's going on around us.
Reverend Jackson, I'd love to hear from you, too, on this. If you've received threats, what you do with those threats, and how you sort of work through it, like Jerry Ann saying, okay, I can't just sit in a hole and say everything's hopeless.
I think Jerry Ann said it perfectly. And I was talking with, over the summer, the pastor at my church I grew up at Canaan Baptist Church of Christ in Harlem, and Dr. Johnson and I were talking, having lunch, and he said to me, either you can, if you sit idle while injustices are happening, if you choose not to act and you choose to sit silent, they're just going to keep happening. You know, and I brought back to that Albert Einstein quote that insanity defined is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. So I'm with Jerry Ann in that in spite of all of that, you know, I've had my own share of death threats, not around because I wasn't present at that event, but I've had my own share of threats through postal mail, social media, and a variety of other sources. But I think the one thing that keeps me going is if I keep silent, nothing's going to change.
What do you do with those threats?
What do I do with them? Well, of course, the best thing to do is to report them to the local police. Report them to the police, and to make sure to the full extent of the law they're held accountable and that they're on the radar of the local police. But apart from that, it's not a lot. It's just I keep going because there's so much to lose by allowing those threats to allow me to be inactive or to remain silent, because that's what they really want. It's not me not existing anymore and physical harm happening to me, that's a secondary goal. You know, that's something that's not their immediate intent. The idea is they just want it to stop.
They want the work to shut you up.
They want the work to stop. And because I don't want the work to be limited to me, so I say not just me to shut up, but
sure.
They don't want this work towards equity, inclusion, diversity. They don't want that to happen. They want the work to stop.
Do you want to jump in, Rabbi Nashi?
Yeah. There's an expression, the Jew lives with hope, and we always have to live with hope. I, too, have received emails or phone calls at our synagogue, others, things that have been threats or spews of hatred, a lot of emails and social media things direct at me. Some of it was a few years ago in response to a work I was doing fighting against a law in this state that would have prohibited the introduction of foreign law into our courts, which was aimed at Sharia law, and it was meant to be an anti-Muslim effort. But there are times when two Jews might agree to involve Jewish law in what they do, and we're bordering Canada. You can see how business people might introduce Canadian law. I mean, there was all sorts of ludicrousness behind the. I've received a fair number of. I had to block some calls. One that came to me in the middle of the night from Paris. But I think we can't, as Reverend Jackson said, we cannot let those things stop us from our commitment to equality and diversity and the fullness of humanity of every person in our world, to recognize the dignity and humanity of each one of us and promote that, celebrate it, love it, embrace it. And I wish I could share. I love your optimism and your desire for conversation, and at the same time recognizing sometimes how hard it is to go there, because when you're sitting across the table from someone who hates you for no other reason of your race or your religion or something, and what you want to do is find that opening into them, it's challenging. It's very challenging to embrace that individual who just would like you removed from the earth. But we have to live with hope and possibility always.
Tom, you want to jump in?
Yeah, we had talked before about victory and how do we feel, and I think a way to look at it is to ask ourselves, what does success look like? And for me, in the field of Holocaust genocide studies, right, is success when nothing happens? And I would say no. I think success is shown when we reach out to folks around this table who have been targeted or or feel that their America isn't safe for them. I think when we look at what's happening in Montgomery, Alabama, with the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, that is putting in the face of Americans really what's at stake here. I think success looks like a memorial in Canterbury Cathedral in England to Jonathan Daniels, who was a civil rights martyr from Keene, New Hampshire, who was killed by a Southern sheriff in 1965, and the white sheriff was acquitted. And yet in the Canterbury Cathedral that my family got a chance to look at, there was Jonathan Daniels and Martin Luther King recognized as heroes. I think success looks like when we can help someone who feels fearful that they're losing something to recognize and help them recognize they're being manipulated by self-interested people who want power, and that what's at stake for them is not losing or having a fear of losing something, but that if they buy into this hatred, they will lose everything. And we will lose everything if we can help them realize that it's in their self-interest to fight racism, bigotry. Our country has grown and got stronger because of diversity, because of immigrants. Whether it be economic opportunities that come anytime there's immigration, whether there's progress when others are recognized, it's to all of our benefit. The boat rises together, right? When the water rises for all of us. And so if we can help them not be afraid to realize it's in their self-interest to resist self-interested, hate-filled people trying to manipulate them, I think that's to our favor. And I think the way I always look at it, there was a story in Israel one time, it was with a person, and he said, you know, there's a forest over there that all died. And I looked at it and I said, oh, that's horrible. And I said, I'm very sorry. Was this a rocket attack, a terrorist attack? He said, no, no. We had one pot of trees that were planted here, and they all died because they caught a disease. He said, now we're smart. We plant like 12 varieties of trees in one area. That way, if a disease comes, only one of the variety of trees dies and the rest thrive. I think it's a great metaphor for diversity. The more we can welcome diversity in our culture, the more we can all thrive and resist those horrible things that kill us all, which is racism, bigotry, and hatred.
We'll close it out there. But thank you all so much for coming in, especially at short notice. I really appreciate it. Gerianne, good to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gerianne Bogus, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. Rabbi Nafshi, thank you for your time.
Always.
Deeply appreciated. Rabbi Nafshi, she is the head of Temple Beth Jacob in Concord. Tom White, good to see you. Thank you for making the trip over from Keene State College. And Reverend Eric Jackson, good to see you too. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Reverend Eric Jackson from Brookside Congregational Church and president of the Greater Manchester NAACP. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.